This is Ralph Metzner, March 7th, 2014. The talk is entitled C.G. Jung, Albert Hofmann, and the Philosopher's Stone. This talk was accompanied by a slideshow, and the slideshow was on the DVD in the library of the Seattle Jung Society. This is part 2 of 2.
And I'm happy to take questions.
Could we take a break?
Yes, please, questions.
Yeah.
I love questions. I may not have an answer, but I will have an answer. Is that a question?
Okay, so if you can remember your reasoning for getting into your studies 30 or 40 years ago and the goal that you set for yourself. And
getting into my studies 30 or 40 years ago? 50 years ago, actually.
50?
Yeah. My first psychedelic experience occurred in 1961.
For the rest of us, right?
Yes, of course. If I'd gone on a different path, it would have been different. But, you know, then I've just finished writing this series of 7 books, but they're all short books. They're like no more than 120 pages, called The Ecology of Consciousness. That's sort of summarizing and distillation of everything that I've learned about states of consciousness and its changes and everything and uses and applications over the past 30, 40 years. And that's what I would, you know, that's what I've been doing. So it's impossible to give a short answer to that question. But we also, Ram Dass and I also wrote a book that's a more personal book. It's a kind of a more autobiographical statement called Birth of a Psychedelic Culture. And with that, written and published about 3 or 4 years ago. It's a form of a dialogue, conversation, and also includes about a 5-year period from early 61 to about 66. When we started the Harvard Psychedelic Project, and then for a while we had this community of people continuing our studies, but no longer under academic auspices at Harvard, but this intentional community in the mid-60s, early 60s at Millbrook, New York. Oh, they really want us to leave. And so that sort of is more the human story, you know, of that period and historical. Although, you know, there have been a number of different books written about that, the Harvard Psychedelic Club, and which has sort of the attitude of, oh, well, that's people did these crazy things and took drugs, and aren't we sophisticated now that we're no longer doing that? And that's sort of the mass culture image of the 60s. You know, it was like a wild and crazy time where people did these wild and crazy things and took these drugs and look how bad that was and da-da-da, and aren't we now so much more mature? That's all false. That whole story is false, completely false. What actually happened was there's a split in the culture. There's a mainstream culture of medical psychiatric research which was basically stopped cold for 20 years. And is only now starting up again in a very, very small scale. But in the meantime, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people went underground. And I no longer use the term counterculture because it's underground, I use underground culture. It's not counter anything. It's not opposed to mainstream culture. It's just underground because it prefers to stay hidden for exactly the same reason as the alchemists stayed hidden. Because people have this weird thing, they actually prefer not to go to jail or have their heads cut off, you know? It's strange. They'd rather go on in. The underground psychedelic culture is thriving and is doing very well, thank you. And some of the underground, you know, emerges into above ground books and publications and writings and scientific research like my books and other people's books, many books. And many people doing, you know, their own individual or group, small group research for spiritual healing and creative inspiration. And of course, there's also misuse and there's recreational use. Of course, that's a different thing. It's a different aspect of culture. That's always going on. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's always going on. Of course, there's alcohol, and there's alcoholism, and there's drunk people using opiate drugs for pain control, and there's people, you know, smoking dope for whatever, and there's marijuana wars, and, you know, it's a big aspect of our culture. So it's an amazing, but one thing is that's very clear is that these consciousness expanding substances or consciousness modifying substances, and I don't include the stimulants and the depressants. I mean they tranquilizers, sedatives, or stimulants like cocaine, and so on—they change consciousness, yes, but not in the same way. The psychedelic consciousness-expanding drugs like LSD, psilocybin, mushrooms, mescaline, peyote, and some of the newer ones like ayahuasca and so forth—it's a completely different category of drugs. In fact, it's a category of drugs that can't be defined as a category. That's the thing; people can't even agree what the name is for them. Because, and you can't answer the question, like when my when a person you know, who has no understanding of that culture asks, well, what does this drug do? I can't answer the question. Well, I have to say, well, it depends on the set, the setting, and your history, and the personality and intentions of the person who's giving it to you, if anybody, what you're trying to do with it, if anything. And if you just want to and that kind of confusion extends even to the internet. You go on the internet to sites like Arrowhead, and you'll see, you know, I tried this drug, I've tried all these other ones, and, you know, there's BBC, FIZ, all these numbers and so on, just to see what it does. And I feel like saying, well, actually, the drug doesn't do anything, really. It doesn't do anything. The question is, what are you doing with the drug? Why are you taking it? And that'll help you understand, you know, even people who are relatively sophisticated and have a lot of history, they still don't often get that point with these drugs. Now, with the stimulants and depressants, it wouldn't matter. If you take a stimulant, amphetamine or something, no matter what your set or intention is, you'll feel a little bit stimulated. Same with the tranquilizer. But not with these drugs. That's why it's so hard to explain. And that's exactly the reason why it's always been esoteric. And will probably always remain esoteric. Because it'll always be misunderstood. Oh, you guys are just taking drugs, right? I can't tell you the number of times I heard that accusation. Oh, you guys are just running around the woods dropping acid. Ha, ha, ha. Why should I take you seriously? Now, that doesn't mean there weren't people running around in the woods taking acid. Of course there were. And the alchemists, the same thing. Oh, you're just the huffers and puffers, right? Trying to make gold, trying to make money, right? Selling drugs. We'll put you in jail for selling drugs. Those are people sitting in jail for 30 years just for selling LSD, mescaline, cannabis, drugs that never hurt a single person. Crimes without victims. How about that? Crimes without victims. We have crimes without victims. And I think, see, I agree with the libertarians in that regard, not in some of the other policies which are sort of nutty. But they say your personal drug use and your personal sexual relations are your business and not the state's and nobody else's. And crimes without victims ought to be taken off the books. Of course it's illegal and should be punished to give a drug to a minor, to give any drug to a minor or have sex with a minor or without to give something to anybody without their consent, explicit consent, and put them into safety. And we already have lots of laws on that thing. But for consenting adults, it's not the state's business. I think it'll always... But, you know, that's a political question. And it's a political issue. It's very much alive, but as we know, look at the marijuana wars going on now. And, yay, you know, I salute the state of Washington. They're pioneering.
Did you study under Ludwig Wittgenstein?
I studied people, Wittgensteinians, yeah. I never met the man myself.
Did he ever, to your knowledge, do a linguistic analysis of consciousness? Did he ever study the word? Did he go into it like...
Did he ever study what?
The word consciousness. was a linguistic. He was a linguist.
I don't know. You'd have to read his books. I'm not a Wittgensteinian philosopher. I studied linguistic philosophy, but it's not my field.
Just wondering if you would give us a little synopsis of the if days.
A little synopsis of the if days? Well, when are we supposed to be out of here? Well, actually, The Birth of a Psychedelic Culture is the book to read. If was this organization, International Federation for Internal Freedom, that Leary, Albert, myself, and a group of other people, I have a dozen people, including Houston Smith, a religious philosopher, started to sponsor research with psychedelics after Harvard stopped the research. The research was sponsored by Harvard at first with psilocybin. And then Harvard no longer wanted to sponsor it, and psilocybin was no longer legally available. But our group continued the research and more with other things that were illegal, that were available, but not, the laws had not yet been passed. It was all perfectly legal. These psychedelic substances didn't become illegal until the late 60s. So this organization was formed to sort of, in general, act as a kind of a network for helping people gather, distributing information for people who wanted to, take responsibility for their own explorations, which is sort of what happened. It didn't last very long. It didn't need to last very long. It served its purpose. As our project left Harvard, some people were fired. I was not fired. Leary was not fired. I didn't have a job. I was a graduate student or a postgraduate student. I couldn't be fired. So neither Leary nor Albert ever regretted anything about doing that. Nobody was harmed. Nobody complained. The student, the undergraduate, we had an agreement to not to give the drugs to undergraduates, but Albert gave a drug to an undergraduate. He didn't complain. He said it was the greatest experience of my life. But his family and the university wanted to get rid of us, clearly. They did not want to have... I did the same as Albert. I gave psilocybin to my girlfriend. She didn't complain. Not at all. Nor did her family. But read The Birth of a Psychedelic Culture. It's a good book. In general, all my books, if you didn't get one here, they're all on my website, which was on the thing there, greenearthfound.org, including some of the other books that I've written that I didn't bring with me. But Birth of a Psychedelic Culture is an interesting book, and it's open-ended. In other words, we don't say, like the Harvard Psychedelic Club, we said, that was a regrettable period when people did these crazy things. And I'll say, no, the story is not over. This is just a particular episode of 5 years.
Humanity is a work in progress.
And so is the so-called whatever psychedelic movement, if it is a psychedelic movement, which has many aspects. It's like a mushroom, It's like a fungus that has lots of tongue. Some of these fungi, fungi are the largest organism on Earth. They've got fungi that extend 50 square miles under the ground, one single organism. This is vast fibrous network under the ground, invisible, in the soil, one organism. We don't know anything. We know so little, We know so little. And we're always thinking of, we know so much. The wrong things, the wrong things. Yes.
I was just curious, I don't know if you mentioned this in the lecture, I might have missed it, but do you think, I was wondering if you're feeling right now that there is a resurgence in psychedelic usage, because personally, I'm just hearing of a lot of people just really starting to experiment with ayahuasca. I've heard some branch of the government or some people are, using MDMA or ecstasy with PTSD, soldiers, and I'm just really getting surprised. I don't know if...
Yes, no, there's an organization called MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which is an organization that sponsors and raises money for a number of research project, and they're doing a lot of really interesting, there are maybe a couple of dozen, Richard, very useful research projects going on, you know, by government approved, and not government funded, by the way. To get the government approval to do them is one thing. To get the money that has to be raised privately, no government agency is going to fund it. But MAPS does that, and there's a number of different projects. The two main areas that I think show the greatest promise is one is the use of MDMA in the treatment of trauma, post-traumatic stress syndrome, war trauma, for example. This is an enormous problem. There are something like 500,000 military people from the different American wars who are suffering from PTSD, untreated, uncured, who commit suicide. Do you know that military people and ex-military people commit suicide at about 20 a month, every month, right now, even as we speak? And MDMA is the only treatment now. It's not a treatment that's available. Research is being done for that treatment to become available to the average GI who, you know, has got trauma. It's going to take $50 million and 5 more years of research projects. $50 million, for that to become, substance to become available as a, you know, where a psychiatrist, certain clinics could, it won't be like a tranquilizer to take a tramway, that's what they give them now. But it has to be an experience. The doctor actually has to sit with the person for 5 or 6 hours. You don't just take one and call me in the morning if you need a refill. You know, it's not like that. And they understand that. They understand that. Now, that area of trauma, MDMA, and MDMA much better than psilocybin or LSD. Then the other big area, very big, maybe even bigger, is the use of LSD and psilocybin. In the treatment of death anxiety, end-of-life anxiety. And the kind of bureaucratic breakthrough there is that certain researchers have gotten permission to give these drugs with the explicit understanding these people have got a terminal diagnosis, they're not going to get cured of their liver cancer or whatever it is, but just to alleviate the anxiety about dying. And as on my website, actually, you'll see a link to two short video clips of dying people who had a terminal diagnosis given psilocybin under a project at UCLA with Charles Grobe, which are very, very moving. And these people talking about what that experience did for them. And when you think about dying, alleviating anxiety or dying, I mean, PTSD is a big problem. End-of-life anxiety is what? Universal. Universal, and there's nothing to treat it. I mean, you have hospice, you know, which alleviates thing, but the anxiety, and for people to, because there's no understanding what death actually is. The culture doesn't really understand death and hasn't for 2,000 years, since the mystery time. And since the Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea of the afterlife and life after death and reincarnation was X'd out of Christian dogma in the 5th century. That means most people, the vast majority of people in the population think, well, when you die, nothing happens. And that's not true. And never has been true. And most cultures in the world understood that. I understand that to this day. Buddhism, Hinduism, reincarnation statement. When you think about what that does to a person. If you think you're so identified with your body and your whole society tells you, well, this body, that's it, and it's going to be a piece of garbage. You know, you're going to bury it in the ground and it'll be just a fading memory in your family's life. Oh, not truthfully. What that means is that you're completely shut off from the larger perspective that your life is just one life. This is just one life in an infinite chain of lives. You have all eternity to learn the lessons of life and death. And so why would you ever want to waste one single one? So that significance of that is enormous. And just from the point of view of the individuals, those two video clips, I recommend them to you. They're very, 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 very moving. these people, you know, just this one woman she's talking about, she had some cancer, liver cancer or something, and she said, I have all these fears, never taken a psychedelic drug before, all these fears, what's going to happen to my husband that loves me, my children, my garden, my home, my body, I'm going to have pain. And then she took the psilocybin, and she said she felt this sort of, all her fears like a fist clutching in her heart, in her chest. Just tight, and then it just dissolved. And she had the thought first, and when it dissolved, she said, all these things I'm afraid of haven't happened. And I'm alive now, and my husband is alive now, and he loves me, and I love him. And I have this beautiful house and this beautiful garden. I love my flowers, my children. She realized she was stuck in the future. Of course she was going to die. She was going to say, yes, but I'm alive now. She lived the rest of her few months, you know, happy. She was happy. She started took up gardening, took up a new thing, spent time with her family. End of life. What a gift that is, you know. What a gift that could be for people. So anyway, it's on my website. You see this, that one and another one. Psilocybin, end of life. So those are the two areas. Then psilocybin also used the treatment of obsessive-compulsive, you know, disorders, which have kind of fixated states of consciousness. So there's about a couple of dozen research projects in different parts of the country, or world, actually, Europe, Spain, France, England, different study. And then, of course, marijuana is another whole vast area. Marijuana is a psychedelic, but, you know, it's also... it has some psychedelic features, but it's also, you know, a very versatile herb and heals all kinds of really serious chronic illnesses. It actually heals certain forms of cancer. Not just alleviates the pain of cancer, it actually heals them. So so there's a lot to do and a lot of things to get involved in. But all of that is above ground, and underground, of course, is another whole story. In my books, I'm talking more about the underground, but I'm also talking about some about the above ground. One more, maybe?
Yeah, just time for one more.
Okay.
Following along on that question I had was, now that Washington's legal, what kind of implications do you think that might have for the consciousness reasoning?
Well, I can only assume that the good people of Washington who choose to partake of cannabis can now do so with a clear conscience and without fear of being busted. And I think they're setting a good example. And the authorities are setting a good example by not just, you know, taking it off the books, but setting up a system for distribution, quality control, da-da-da-da-da-da. You can't just, you know, just rush out there and do it. So it's a social experiment, and it's, you know, there's 48 states, so who knows how long it'll take Alabama to legalize it. But then not everybody wants to live in Alabama, you know. And the same is happening in other countries. You know. If you go to Indonesia, you can get thrown in jail. You can get the death penalty for having drugs. It's a big world. So, and just like people, a big variety. So I did want to mention that in the workshop tomorrow, maybe some of you are coming, we're going to be doing some guided meditation processes. No drugs will be taken, of course, except the ones that you take yourself, like caffeine in the morning. That is a drug, by the way. But we'll be doing processes of exploring consciousness. We do some memory processes and some visioning processes using the vehicle, because the drug plays the role of an accelerator, or amplifier of awareness. What we'll be using, shamanic methods of rattling with a drum, you know, where the rhythmic rattle rather than a drum. So that's a shamanic method, provides an aid to concentration in doing a shamanic journey, and meditation, guided meditation processes, which can also change consciousness, and divinations in the sense of asking questions, maybe looking at certain periods in your life and what the implications are, like that. So I look forward to seeing some of you. Shall we leave it at that?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.